It's WrestlePod, the Troopany Show, with your host, James Troopany.
Hello and welcome to the Troopany Show. My name is James Troopany and this is my show. And today we are back with Beginner's Guide to Japanese Professional Wrestling. We're looking at All Japan Pro Wrestling today and a couple of other things that went off in the same time period in the early 1970s. And to join me to discuss these greatest wonders, historical things, is Mr. Alex Edwards. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you. Have you enjoyed your week revising and reviewing All Japan Pro?
It's definitely been interesting. I was just saying just then that of the two major Japanese companies, All Japan and New Japan, New Japan is the one that I've always sort of gravitated towards a bit more.
Yeah.
And so it was interesting to look back at All Japan, which I've never really delved into properly before, and sort of see where all this stuff sort of started off. It's been an interesting week.
And we hope you find it interesting too. We're going to give you some things to have a look out for and things to go watch, which I'm sure you can go find on YouTube because that's what we did. And some interesting points in All Japan history. And we're really looking at the King's Road style and the start of King's Road, which is very different from Strong Style. And we want to kind of explain that really, really well so you get an understanding and understand better the different styles of Japanese wrestling. But we'll go for a break and pay some bills, and we'll be back after that.
WrestlePlus.com is the brand new home of incredible online wrestling content, featuring uncensored shoot interview classics, full series of WrestleTalk TV and British Wrestling Weekly, exclusive documentaries, British wrestling's biggest names before they were stars, an incredible podcast collection, up to 90% off merchandise offers, and the brand new Power Slammed e-magazine forwarded by Finn Martin himself. WrestlePlus has thousands of hours of content, with new and exclusive releases added regularly. You can join today for the stupidly low price of just £4.99 a month. Wrestle Plus, because this is wrestling.
Welcome back. Let's start with overall impressions rather than going into individuals because I think that's really important. When you've got fresh eyes coming to a product, it's something you've not seen before. You're obviously probably calibrating for age. What did you think of this particular style and this particular presentation and how All Japan was trying to pitch its message?
So, coming at it as someone who got into wrestling in the early 2000s and got into predominantly sort of American WWE style, it was a bit, I guess, strange going back to the 70s and seeing something that's, while you can see the similarities, it's a very different product and it's a very different presentation of wrestling.
It
was enjoyable to watch in that you can see, when you watch modern day Japanese stuff, you can see sort of where it came from and the sort of, you see things in this early stuff which makes you think, so that's why they do this. That's, you know, it's the formative period, I guess. And we were just saying, as we started recording, I was watching a match and a snapmare was being used as a sort of, it was towards the end of a match and it was a big devastating move, a snapmare.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking, a snapmare is nothing nowadays. And you were saying that in British wrestling at the time, a snapmare was just a transition. And so it's interesting to see not only the different style at the time, but different style sort of where in the world you go.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that, like, and I was explaining to you as well, like I watched a match from the 1970s when I was writing a piece called The Lancastrians for WrestleTalk, and there was a Royal Brothers versus Johnny Quango and Honey Boy Zimba match where a pile driver and a power bomb were just transition moves. They were just little shine spots for the faces there. That's all they were. They weren't like, you know, proper kind of like match ending, oh my God, destruction moves that we expect them to be today. So there is a kind of, I suppose as well, coming out of the JWA and where things have come before, they're kind of trying to find a style, aren't they? They're trying to lay the foundations for what their style is going to be. As it's clear, I think what's interesting to me, though there's still kind of core elements of JWA that's in New Japan, it certainly seems to break off in a different direction. When we were discussing this with Chelsea, it seemed very different to what we were looking at in JWA. Whereas All Japan seems to be a continuation of what JWA was trying to do with a few tweaks here and there. Does that make sense?
Whereas Inoki was trying to recreate wrestling and create this brand new style and revolutionize it. Baba sort of decided to sort of stick to what everyone was used to a bit, build upon it, but still stick to what wrestling was at the time.
Yeah, I suppose the difference is Inoki was revolution and Baba was evolution.
Mm.
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair thing to say. And we should really outline the history of All Japan Pro Wrestling, because we haven't done yet. And we've kind of got stuck in there straight away. So let's take a step back. All Japan was formed in 1972. Out of the ashes of the JWA. Once Antonio Inoki had left to go and form New Japan Pro Wrestling, the old JWA kind of limped along, but backstage politics, as you know, when there's a power vacuum because one of the big players has left, kind of all went down the tubes. And the first card for All Japan Pro Wrestling, which was Baba's promotion, started on October 21st, 1972 in Tokyo. Now, All Japan Pro Wrestling was kind of unique in the sense of it was actually partly owned by the TV station Nippon TV, which is one of the big Japanese networks that also had a stake in the JWA. So it was inherently there as a television product, which is not something you saw anywhere else in the world. If you look at the UK, the British television, the ITV, paid the promoters to put a show together which they would film, which was probably the best deal in wrestling at the time when you think about it.
Yeah,
they didn't have
sure.
any on cost whatsoever. And the flip side of that was the majority of American companies had a similar deal where the TV company would either film it or they'd make a TV show and sell it to the TV company. But the two entities were different. All Japan was actually owned, partly owned by Nippon TV, which comes into play much later in the All Japan story, but we'll get to that in a few episodes' time. But for now, they've got a TV presence guaranteed, which almost guarantees ticket sales. They have Giant Baba, who is the biggest star of the JWA, probably bigger than Inoki, I would think, just slightly. And they really start off on a strong footing. They're kind of developing, they're kind of taking that JWA style and reapplying it, and they've got a good homegrown roster, Akio Saito, Kutsuwada, Okuma, Koma, Momota, but I think the really important thing for them is also they have access to the NWA and the NWA World Heavyweight Champion, which they carried forward from their days in JWA. But let's get to the key man, Giant Baba. What's your impressions of Baba, Alex, as the key leader of this particular style and this particular company?
Baba was interesting to watch. I mean, he's got a very unique look, especially for the time, being, what was he, 6'10", which is huge for a Japanese wrestler. And you sort of, he comes across as a very, I guess, prototypical baby face, if that makes sense, where at least from the matches I saw, a lot of it was he'd be selling, come back with a big sort of explosive move and then get the fall, which I think when you look at more modern stuff. So, for example, like Hulk Hogan, it's that same sort of the big good guy that gets beat down, hits his big move, gets the win. Yeah. And it was interesting to see that Baba, I don't know if he was like the originator of that sort of thing or if it's something he carried on from like a Ricky Dozan or something like that, but it was very interesting to see the sort of formation of sort of this stereotype that we now have in wrestling.
Yeah, I mean, I think the majority of like Japanese wrestlers from JWA onwards did spend time in the States, so he would have had time to learn from the great baby faces in his American runs, and he was very popular, though he was never a big draw. He was very popular in New York. He was very popular in Puerto Rico. You know, I saw him in having a feud with Bruiser Brody in the late 80s in Puerto Rico, you know, and obviously if you're wrestling Brody in Puerto Rico, that's insane.
It's a pretty big deal. Yeah.
That's essentially like, you know, well, there's going to be a riot. You know there will be. So yeah, he was really, yeah, a prototypical babyface, and he had an interesting, because of his body type, I believe he was afflicted with giantitis, but maybe not as heavily as other giants we know of in the pro wrestling industry. And his body shape was very unique, very big, barrel-chested guy, but he wasn't muscly.
Yeah,
either,
he was sort
he?
Of big, but then he had like very sort of, I guess, skinny arms, and like you said, it was a unique look which sort of set him apart from anyone else at the time.
Yeah, and a former baseball player as well. He played for the Tokyo Giants, funnily enough, and was a baseball star. And when he finished his baseball career, he was picked out by Ricky Dozan as one of his successors and was starting to be groomed as one of his successors. And eventually he becomes like the man in All Japan Pro Wrestling, the lead babyface. He certainly wasn't... I find his stuff interesting. I wouldn't say he's as good a worker as Inoki, because I don't think there was many in that era as good as Inoki.
Mm.
Chelsea described him as Inoki as perfectly average at everything.
Yeah.
Whereas Baba was more of a spectacle wrestler. He understood spectacle really, really well. He understood how to make moments count, I think, which is a great thing if you're not as technically adept as the people around you.
Very much so. I think it was something I definitely noticed where whenever he was on the offense, he was doing these huge sort of explosive movements, which really made even like a punch or a body slam or something, they really stood out as, oh, that was a really devastating move. And like you said, I guess it's sort of covering for a lack of technical expertise.
Yeah, and I think he really shone in tag matches as well. That's really useful, getting a hot tag and coming in and exploding with power. That really came across. I did notice this with tag matches a lot, actually, just from a style point of view. There wasn't a lot of hot tags going on. There was a lot of back and forth, which is kind of a modern Japanese wrestling trait. They don't necessarily have hot tags. One of the questions on the Daily Squash about 2 years ago was someone asked Alex Shane, could you have matches without hot tags? And he said no. But I look at Japanese wrestling and they have matches without hot tags all the time. Matches tend to peter out.
Yeah.
You get that period where a babyface is getting beat on and beat on and you're just expecting, well, it's going to be a hot tag, and then you just get pinned.
And then, yeah, that's just it.
That's it.
You got outclassed. That's the end.
That's it. That's the story. And I think that's something interesting that, you know, you could probably play around with a lot more in North American wrestling if promoters had the kind of like bravery to do it. But, you know, they tend to stick to the formulaic, what works, because that's what works. That's what draws money, and that's what's going to tell that story for that particular market. So I found that very interesting. And Baba had some interesting feuds in this time period. Because of that connection with the NWA, you got certain characters like the Funk Brothers, Dory Funk Jr. and Terry Funk, were spending a lot of time in Japan. Previously, they'd spent a lot of time in JWA, and that association from the NWA comes into Giant Baba and All Japan Pro Wrestling, and that would be really, really important when it came to training excursions for the Japanese talent, because they were going to spend a lot of time in Texas, which will, you know, it will flavor our podcast about All Japan and the King's Road style for quite a few episodes to come. Did you see any of the matches with the Funks in Japan?
I only saw one. I think it was Dory Funk against, I think it was Jack Briscoe,
yeah,
for the NWA heavyweight title. Yeah, I mean, what can you say? The Funks are the Funks are the Funks.
Yeah, they were awesome. I watched the tag match between Baba and, I'm just trying to find his name, where is he? It would have been Kutsuwada. Yeah, Baba and Kutsuwada against the Funk Brothers. Mm. And it was exceptional. And it was, a lot of it was down to how the Funks came across. They came across as gentleman heels, if you will. They didn't cheat per se, but they were taking advantages. It's very much like the sports presentation that we're kind of used to from New Japan today. Though they were the Geijin, they were very much respected, as both were former NWA heavyweight champions. They were very much respected for their skill set. And it was, you know, the Funks were the first ones to really break the mold of Geijins being good guys in Japan. You know, they were the ones, the originators of Geijins don't have to be evil. They can be anything you want them to be. And they set that groove there, really, with, you know, these matches against Baba and various partners.
So this sort of early 70s, like late 60s, early 70s, was the sort of transition from the nationalistic sort of heel foreigner versus babyface Japanese guy to sort of a more level playing field with a bit of both on each side.
Yeah, really. I mean, if you look back and compare and contrast the Shaw brothers, say, who were wrestling Ricky Dozan and Kimura 10 years before, they were, well, 15 years before, they were a heel team. They cheated. They were bigger than their opponents. They used every advantage and shortcut they could. They would attack between falls. They did everything like that. When you watch Terry and Dory's approach to their matches there, very respectful, shake hands at the beginning of the match. They might take a shortcut or two. They might go through past the five count a little bit onto double teams. But generally speaking, they keep it within the realms of the rules and they're making match interesting through their actions. And there's the classic Terry overselling moments and there's, and there's the Dory being the ice cold killer he can be. But they do it more in the ring than anything else. And that fascinates me because it kind of built an alternate universe for All Japan where these Gaijin that came in were noble and these guys could wrestle and they were exceptional technicians. The good example you have there is an NWA World Championship match between Jack Briscoe and Dory Funk Jr. So Jack Briscoe, I guess at the time, was they were in Florida, weren't they? They were running the Florida territory. So you've got the biggest promoter in Florida wrestling against one of the biggest promoters in Texas for the biggest championship in the world in Tokyo. And you can see how important the NWA becomes to All Japan in that moment.
And that's the one I saw. And they have an hour-long match. It's like, almost hour-long. It's crazy.
Yeah. And held your attention for an hour?
It was good. I mean, there was a lot of sort of ground-based stuff, which obviously you're going to have to do that when you're going an hour to just sort of have a little bit of a breather. But no, it was a good match. And they kept my attention right the way through. Like, even when they were on the ground, they were doing this sort of really interesting submission-based style. And it was, it was cool to see.
Yeah, it was really interesting, kind of like the business options they had there and who could come in and do things and who could do different things. And the people they were getting as Gaijin talent, some of them were coming in on short terms via the NWA connection, like the Funk Brothers, like the Briscoe brothers. Some were coming in on slightly longer deals, like Abdullah the Butcher, which we talked about a lot in the New Japan episode. And sometimes we get overlaps with this because people went back and forth. So Abdullah really started in Japan, in All Japan. He didn't start in New Japan. He went to New Japan after building a name for himself in All Japan. And one person I found really interesting was the Destroyer. The Destroyer made his name, his first run, by wrestling Ricky Dozan in the early 60s. And the Destroyer was a former amateur wrestling great called Dick Bauer, who started off in the AWA. And he went to JWA. He wrestled Ricky Dozan in front of the biggest television wrestling audience of all time. I think it was a 63% rating in 1962. That made his name for him. And he was the PWF US champion in All Japan. He signed for 6 years in the 1970s. And he just stayed in Japan. Didn't wrestle for anyone else. Didn't do shots for anyone else. Just stayed in Japan. He was a babyface. He was a technical mat wrestler. I think he lost the championship a couple of times to Abdullah. I saw one of his matches with Abdullah, which was really interesting because it was blood everywhere.
Yeah, I think I mentioned the same one. It's
yeah.
Just...
I was kind of like fascinated me is like, here's Dick Bauer. He's clearly a guy who's really at home in North America. You know, he wrestled for the AWA, and since he retired, he stayed in North America. I was joking with Chelsea during the week because I wanted to go visit his golf course. He has a golf course in Akron, New York called the Destroyer Golf Course.
That's fantastic.
That's awesome. I'm trying to persuade Chelsea to take up golf just so she can go visit that for us and take some pictures. He just went there for 6 years and he was on good money. He was a PWF US heavyweight champion. He was a good draw. He had some really cracking matches. I found that interesting. And that, I guess he was kind of the prototype for what would happen later in All Japan when Baba started to tie up people in deals longer term. But he was the kind of like the first guy to do that. I found that really interesting. And the matches he had were really interesting as well. Did you see the one with Abdullah I guess it must be like a public park or something?
No, it wasn't in a park. The one I saw was back in 74, I think it was. It was him, they were in an arena and it was very bloody. It was a big sort of brawl all over the place. It's just interesting to see how the crowd reacts to that kind of thing because they get really hot for this sort of thing, but then they also get really hot for the the sort of slower ground-based stuff that we were talking about with Jack Briscoe and Dory Funk. It's just interesting to see how, no matter what's in the ring, they're reacting somehow and they're really getting into it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I watched two matches with Dick Bauer. I watched him, the first one I saw him was watching Wrestling Mil Máscaras. So that's a whole different thing to Wrestling Abdullah. I think you possibly couldn't get two more different people.
Yeah.
So you've got, Dick Bauer's Wrestling Mil Máscaras. They're both faces. Neither of them are cheating. As with all main events in All Japan, it's best of three falls, very traditional. And they have a wrestling match. No one breaks any rules. No one does anything rum. Everyone's a face. And Bauer wins. I think they had two falls and they went to time limit. So it was a draw. And they shook hands and went about their way. And then he's wrestling, defending against Abdullah the Butcher. And the Destroyer runs into the ring and just belts Abdullah to start with. Just like belts him across the face with the championship belt or something like that. And then they just start brawling around this. The one I saw, they were outside. It was a public park, almost been a public outdoor venue. And they're just brawling around the crowd for 10 minutes. They don't even get in the ring. And the referee is just screaming at them to get them back in the ring. And they just don't go. And
that just makes it even better that it was outside as well. And yeah. It's just two guys having a brawl in the middle of the park.
Yes, family-orientated entertainment. There you go. And there's blood flying everywhere. And, of course, Destroyer's mask is half pulled off. And he's got big gouges in his forehead. And his Abdullah, who's bleeding because it's Abdullah. And that's what he does.
Yeah, the one I've seen is Abdullah's like just basically stabbing him in the forehead with a spike, and his like Destroyer's wearing like the white mask, all covered. It's all red on the face.
Yeah, it's really bizarre. Like, you know, we tend to think of All Japan Pro Wrestling as one of the most conservative wrestling promotions there is. You know, when we get later on, he was very dismissive of his former protégés, Tenryu and Atsushi Inita, for getting involved in what he called garbage wrestling, the hyper-violent wrestling of FMW and IWA. Yet, you look at these matches, and one of the bloodiest matches I actually saw in this period I've been looking at was Giant Baba versus Fritz von Erich from about 1976. You know, I don't necessarily, it was a Texas death match, so there was obviously going to be some blood in it, but I think early in the match, Fritz ends up dropping out the ring and splitting his head open on the floor when he lands.
Right.
And Fritz is just covered in blood. His whole chest hair is matted up with blood. Baba's bleeding as well, and it's all basically Fritz is trying to draw blood through the Iron Claw. That's what he's trying to do, and that's the angle. I doubt, as strong as the Iron Claw was, I don't think it's that strong. and it's just like, and it's a fairly bloody battle, and you're kind of like, there's a dichotomy there. There's a crossover there, that the duality to it that's really interesting for me. When we think later in All Japan, we think of Tenryu and Jumbo Tsuruta and Atsushi Inita and that 80s period of great wrestling that lays the foundation for the Triple Crown era with Stan Hansen and Steve Williams and Kawada and Misawa. But there was a lot of maneuvering to get the King's Road into place before you got there.
For sure. It's like you said, they were sort of in that transition from the old school JWA style to trying to find a new identity. And I guess this period when they first started out in the 70s was just them sort of throwing a lot of ideas out there and trying to find something that works, and then sort of build it, taking little bits of whatever they throw and building upon that King's Road style.
Yeah. I mean, I found it fascinating that you've got so many different styles of wrestlers. I'm just looking at the PWF Championship, which is the number one championship for All Japan. There was the United National Championship, which was kind of like the co-number one championship. They were kind of doing two titles at the top long before the Intercontinental and IWGP Heavyweight Championships as well. That's an interesting point. But you look at the big draws as a championship reflects in the first 10 years of the company, from 73 to 83. Giant Baba, Torquemada, Billy Robinson, Abdullah the Butcher, Giant Baba, Harley Race and Stan Hansen. And that's how many champions there was in that 10-year period. And it's like,
yeah, you don't get many different styles than that. It's
Sort of
all over the place.
Yeah, you've got Giant Baba, who's this big spectacle-led fan favorite, and then you've got Billy Robinson, arguably the most technically proficient pro wrestler of all time, against Abdullah the Butcher. How does that work? Actually, I've seen that match. It is actually phenomenally good because they're both pros and they know how to make it work. And then you've got Harley Race, the definitive NWA champion, and Stan Hansen, the Texas Brawler's Texas Brawler. You know, you have such a wide-ranging kind of way of how this all fits together. It's interesting that all of those different styles make up the King's Road style.
For sure. But then when you watch a King's Road match, you do see the sort of elements of each in there. And like you said, it's interesting to see how a new style can be brought about just by combining little bits of other things from elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, we talked a lot about the Strong Style in the Strong Style episode when we're talking about New Japan, how they took that realistic sports element from Carl Gotch and Antonio Inoki and tried to apply more martial arts to it. And I find it fascinating that All Japan kind of sticks with, we're going to have more pro wrestling moves and it's going to be much more a pro wrestling thing, but we're going to make them harder and stiffer and heavier to make them look more impressive. Even though we know they are not real maneuvers you could use in a fight, but we're going to try and make them impressive by this way of doing it rather than trying to make it look like a real sport.
But it works, and the crowd loved it. So
yeah, and I think it also gives them an advantage in a booking format because you're not having to, in a real sport, a match can end at any time. If you look at UFC, matches can last for 3 seconds or they can last for half an hour.
Yeah.
And when you're booking Strong Style in that way, you have to reflect that. You know, you can't have every match last 28 minutes. Whereas with All Japan, there's an expectation there's going to be a certain amount of time because a certain wrestler needs to do certain things against a certain wrestler to make this work.
And you're going to get a full show out of that, and you're going to get your money's worth of entertainment out of that.
Yeah, exactly. So it's interesting how this all pans together. Let's have a quick chat about championships, because like I said, there was actually three major titles. There was the PWF Championship, and we'll talk about the PWF in a minute, because that was interesting. There was the NWA International Heavyweight Championship, which was the title I talked about from JWA during the JWA episode that was founded in 1957 when Luthes went on a skiing holiday and did a title championship to defend. And Baba took that with him from JWA. The first championship match, this is interesting, the first championship match for the NWA International Heavyweight Championship was in 1972 in All Japan, and it was won by Bobo Brazil for the vacant championship. Huh. There you go. There's a big name you don't hear too much of in Japan.
Yeah, I hadn't even really realised that he'd been in Japan.
Yeah, there you go. And then Dory Funk, Kentaro Oki won it in Hiroshima, and then Dory Funk Jr. had it for a while as well. So yeah, interesting. And there was also the United National Championship, which was founded in originally from St. Louis, Missouri. So it was a championship based in the United States of America, which found its way to Japan over the 3-year period from the early 1970s. The last champion in the JWA of that belt was Antonio Inoki.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh,
there you go.
And eventually it found itself to All Japan via Seiji Sakaguchi, who won the championship in 1972, and it became an All Japan stalwart. Now, essentially, you had three major championships in the company over a period of about 20 years or so. Now, today, they're all part of the Triple Crown Championship. But there was good reasons for keeping those championships apart, I think, in that particular time period, because it allowed people to establish themselves and really get over with a belt. And you didn't have that, the secondary championship feeling like a secondary championship. Because when I watch these title matches, they all seem very important. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I understand what you mean. And I guess it also gives more of a excuse, I guess, to have people. So, for example, if they were to bring in a Gaijin for a short tour and he wins the title, they don't have to have him drop it before he goes because they've got the two others to rely on in the meantime. It's just, it gives them more options to do more with their storytelling.
Yeah, and they had even lower championships like this. The PWF had the US Heavyweight Championship that Dick Bauer, the Destroyer, had. You know, so there was, I think sometimes, you know, some companies have the problem of just having too many championships. WWE get accused of this a lot, and I can understand that.
It's also something that New Japan has been accused of a lot currently, yeah. where they brought in, like, for a time, the Never Openweight Championship was just a useless belt that nobody cared about. And then it's been, over the last couple of years, with Shibata and Ishii, it was built up as something that really mattered. But then them introducing the six-man tag team titles early this year, it's just sort of like, is that one too many?
Yeah.
I mean, I can understand the need for it when you're headlining a lot of your smaller shows with six-man tag matches. It just gives them something to sort of be for. But yeah, it's a criticism that's been thrown around.
Yeah, and but this seems to work. They seem to keep these championships separate and keep them special for a very long time, you know, and then they have secondary championships below that. And also, essentially, you had two governing bodies, which is a story that plays out in other Japanese promotions, the actual governing body being separate to the promotion. So you had the NWA as the main governing body, but you also had the PWF, the Pacific Wrestling Federation. Am I right with those initials?
That is right. Yeah,
Pacific Wrestling Federation, which was kind of all their home championships, so the PWF championship, and it was chaired by Lord Bleers, who was an old Minnesota wrestler who wrestled for the AWA for a very long time. And he was the representative of the PWF, and he was the one that made all the decisions as far as the championship committee was concerned on the screen anyway.
So I guess you could say it's sort of similar in a way to how New Japan had the IWGP.
Yeah, and yeah.
I always found it interesting how a lot of Japanese companies do that, where their championships won't be like the New Japan Championship or the All Japan Championship. They'll have an external governing body. It makes it similar to sort of boxing in a way, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's the interesting thing. I think it, and you know, you can look at even like the Joshi Promotions, All Japan's major championship wasn't the All Japan Women's Championship. It was the WWWA Women's Championship.
Mm.
You know, it was the old, there was history there. There was lineage from the old WWWA, which had lineage to the original Women's Heavyweight Championship. So there was good reasons for doing that. But when Chigusō Nagayo starts Gaia, she sets up the AAAW organization to be the governing body for Gaia. You know, it wasn't until like the last 10 or 15 years or so that the promotion has its own championships. So yeah, it is interesting, and it does kind of give a sense of legitimacy to what you're doing as well, especially if you've got highly respected retired wrestlers like Lord Bleers looking after that particular administrative side for you as well.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess it may also be sort of that NWA influence, where obviously the NWA was the governing body for a lot of the territories across America, and it's something sort of carried over to Japan.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting as well, the names that they've got that are coming in to All Japan. We talked a little bit about Billy Robinson and his run with the PWF and United National Championships. Did you see much of Billy in this particular era?
Again, a couple of matches, but not too much. It was just, it's like you said, where they had a lot of different styles clashing in there at once. And it's almost like when you think of the early UFC, where the concept was different fighting styles going up against each other to see which fighting style is the best.
Yeah.
You get that sort of thing here, where, like we were saying, you have Billy Robinson being the sort of perfect technical wrestler, and then you have Abdullah the Butcher, you have the Sheik, you have Stan Hansen, you have Giant Baba. It's like, it's a lot of different styles all clashing together, and Billy Robinson was one that he stood out, I guess, as very influential in the sort of style that we would see going forward.
Yeah, he was also a trainer there, if I remember correctly.
That might be why then.
One of the first books I read as a wrestling book that actually went inside the business was a book called Thumbs Up Boy, which is the story of British wrestler Joe Cornelius. And Joe spent a lot of time in Japan he spent a lot of time globetrotting the world in the 1960s for the main reason he couldn't find too many jobs in the UK, and he would get a phone call from a promoter somewhere in Singapore or India or Australia. And he'd get there, and Bert Azzurati would be waiting for him at the airport, and he'll say, "Ah, thanks for coming. No one will wrestle me here. would you mind?"
Just do us a favor.
Yeah, just do us a favor. And I'll, and as Joe said, it was a typical Azzurati match of he would make you look like an absolute $1 million for the first two rounds, and then he would kill you.
That's great.
Yeah, because Bert was as tough as they come. Bert was a snake pit graduate. I'm sure he had the world bench pressing record. He was literally built like, I can't think of a guy to describe him. If you look him up on the internet, you'll find pictures of him. But he was built like a modern day power lifter, but could move like a gymnast. And he was snake pit trained shoot fighter.
Wow.
So he was he was as good as it got, you know. And he was one of the globe-trotting guys because he got blackballed by so many promoters for going into business for himself. He would go to all promotions around the world, and after about a week, none of the local roster of talent would want to wrestle him.
It's like right off the next place.
So he'd call Joe, and Joe would go, "Yeah, all right," and fly off to the middle of nowhere to wrestle Bert again and show how these youngsters go on. And he built that reputation, and a similar call came from Billy Robinson. And Billy said, "I want you to come over to train." And Joe said, "Well, I've been kicked around by Bert Azzurati for the last 2 years. I don't really fancy wrestling anyone." He said, "Don't worry, you just have to train them when you get here." And of course, Joe got asked to go and wrestle the local guys. And so, you know, that's how he did. So Joe Cornelius and Billy Robinson did have an influence on that style. And certainly Robinson had an influence on New Japan as well. All Japan Pro Wrestling, he does spend some time in New Japan pushing that strong style further. And we'll see Billy Robinson in Japan much later on as we get into the shoot era in the 1990s. And he was incredibly influential there. Mm. But yeah, it's interesting that, you know, Billy Robinson does so well. He's got that shoot Lancastrian British wrestling style, which shouldn't necessarily mesh really well with the All Japan style, which is much more American influenced, yet it does. And like you said, it's like that UFC kind of early days clash of styles and how it all fits together. I found Billy Robinson in All Japan an interesting watch. I would strongly recommend the match with Abdullah the Butcher over the PWF Heavyweight Championship. That is really, it was October 18th, 1978. If you want to see how really to get somebody over who's not in your style, that's a really important lesson. And I think that's really important to see how, you know, those style clashes can work really, really well.
Yeah, and that just seems like a match that wouldn't work at all. But I mean, that's not the one I saw, but I can imagine that they would have found a way to make it work.
Yeah, well, I mean, Abdullah used to get a lot of respect from the shoot guys because he made money. You know, there was the story Abby told of when he was first in Toronto, when he was first working out the Abdullah the Butcher character, and he was supposed to wrestle Lou Thesz. And all the old-timers all weekend were saying to him, "Oh, Lou's going to come and kill you. He hates gimmick guys. He's going to kill you. You're going to be in hospital after this weekend. Lou's going to kill you." On the day of the fight, he's in the dressing room and he hears a tap on the window and he opens it and it's Lou Thesz.
Oh, God.
and apparently he said to Abdullah, "I know what you're thinking. Anything you want to do, champ, is fine by me."
Wow.
And then he went back to his dressing room. Because, you know, that's the way it worked. So, yeah, so Abdullah, you would imagine Billy Robinson shutting down Abdullah in about 10 seconds flat if he took something on with him, but he was willing to make it work and he was willing to make it show. Interesting finish to that match as well. Billy went out with an injury. He lost the championship on an injury and couldn't continue. It was a technical knockout. It wasn't a pinfall, which does say a little bit of protection for Billy there, which he may have insisted upon to losing to the butcher, which I think is fair enough because it protects the draw of both of them. Looking at other big names in this particular era as well, you've got some interesting names. You've got Jumbo Tsuruta, who's just starting out. We're going to talk about him in a different episode. Dick Murdoch, another NWA affiliate. We talked about him in the New Japan episode as well. So you do get a lot of talent floating back and forth, but one of the biggest names was the NWA heavyweight champion Harley Race. And Harley had a great relationship with Giant Baba. They were incredibly close friends. And Giant Baba's two NWA championship reigns were probably more down to Harley Race wanting to create some interest in Japan rather than the NWA board allowing some interest in Japan. certainly the second title reign, I know, was decided over dinner the night before.
That's great. Yeah. I mean, that sums up a lot of wrestling, I guess.
Yeah, it does. It's just like Harley like Baba, and that was it. That was
yeah. It's when, like, you go back to that. I think it was you and Chelsea saying in the New Japan episode about how a lot of wrestling can be compared to sort of the mafia in a way.
Yeah, definitely. Like,
yeah, I like you, so you're winning. You're getting this.
Yeah, or, this will happen. Yeah. And it's interesting, if you've seen those matches, I first saw them, I think it was Rudo Reels did a DVD of the NWA title in Japan, and it was like I saw the first time Race got beat by Baba.
Mm.
And it's not the best Harley Race match I've ever seen, but the crowd are so into it, just so into it, because it's the hometown boy. Baba finally gets his chance in his home ground against Harley Race, best of three falls, and the crowd just go crazy for that match. They're just insanely over for that match. And Harley does the gentlemanly thing, despite cheating for the previous 45 minutes to try and retain the title. Baba finally pins him, and Harley walks over and shakes his hand, and the place goes crazy. You know, this is like, you see how cool wrestling can be in this moment.
Yeah.
You know, it's probably not the best NWA championship match. If I was putting a list of the greatest NWA title matches together, this wouldn't be on it, even though it was a championship change. But certainly from a crowd reaction point of view, and again, you know, crowds are maybe something interesting we should talk about. It's very respectful, but when something cool really happens, they are really into it.
Yeah, and it's something I was saying earlier about how in the sort of the big brawl with Destroyer and Abdullah, the crowd were going mental for some of the stuff. But then you see them in... So speaking of Harley Race, I saw a match he had with Dusty Rhodes in All Japan, and the crowd are very sort of, you know, quiet, respectful. They'll clap when a move happens and they'll go back to sort of observing. And that's the sort of stereotype you have of Japanese crowds. But there are the moments where they do get really into something and they're going crazy. And it's cool to see how telling a story well can really get people into something and get people really riled up.
Yeah, I think that's you know, and I think Harley Race, master storyteller that Harley Race was, he was just the guy to be NWA champion in this era, you know. And there's no knock on the other NWA champions of this era, but, you know, Race's matches are all about telling stories and making the local guy look like $1 million.
Mm.
That's basically what got him to be so useful to the NWA. He was a guy that prided himself on making the other people look good, and this did All Japan Pro Wrestling no end of good as well. You know, it really established the company, and other visitors included Bruno Sammartino during his breaks from the WWWF, as it was then. We talked about enough of that on the New Japan podcast of getting them pigging initials right. But Bruno went to All Japan during his breaks from the WWF Heavyweight Championship. And he was actually wrestled as a heel in one match I saw him in against Baba. You know,
that is interesting.
Yeah, and he was a really good heel as well. I guess he was just wanting to do something different because it didn't really matter to him. It was just a big appearance.
Yeah, I guess if you think about it, at the time, no one in America would have seen that match because there'd be no way for them to see it. And yeah. So it does just give a lot of the gaijin talent just an opportunity to, like you said, do something different, try new things, just have a bit of a break from their usual shtick and have a bit of fun.
Yeah, I think so. You know, and also Baba was another big friend with Sammartino. Bruno actually bought him a car. You heard this story.
That's nice. No, I haven't.
This was... Bruno was... I think he was like stood waiting outside the hotel just talking to people. And Joe Higuchi, Tokyo Joe Higuchi, he was a booker for All Japan for years and years and years. And he's talking with Joe, and Baba gets out, climbs into this tiny Datsun, like folds himself into it and then drives off. and he's talking to Joe, and he goes, why doesn't he buy a bigger car? And Joe says, well, you can't buy big cars in Japan. They don't really exist, and we can't import them. It's really hard to get imported cars.
Yeah.
He said, so we just have to put up with what we got. And he went, well, if I gave him a car? And he was like, yeah, that would work, because it's a gift. You don't have to worry about taxation then. Okay, then. So when Bruno went home, he was selling his Cadillac, and he shipped his Cadillac to Japan for Baba.
Oh.
And it's just because he was like, you know, Baba deserves a ride. Yeah, and when he went back to Japan, he saw Baba get in the back of his Cadillac with a big cigar, and he had a driver, and he was much happier. So that was so cool. And apparently kept it till the day he died as well. So there you go. Would not part with it because it was a gift from Bruno. And it's just like those cool stories about pro wrestling as well. We know enough horror stories about guys getting stiffed on deals and ruthless promoters. But Baba was a really respected promoter in the NWA. He was respected in Japan. His word was bond. You know, Dynamite Kid talks in his autobiography about when they left All Japan Pro Wrestling. He'd signed a contract for All Japan, but they'd never shaken hands on it. And he didn't necessarily feel bad about it, because it's like, well, WWE would probably sort that problem because they were talking to Baba anyway.
Yeah.
But if they'd shaken hands on it, they would not have gone to the WWE. You know, and Baba insisted. Baba had his thumb in the air to what was going on in the wrestling world, and Baba had always given the guarantee for the next tour to make sure they came back. And on their last tour before they finished with All Japan, whilst they were still in the WWF, Baba said, you can pick up your bonus next time you come. You pick up your starter check next time you come.
Yeah.
And of course, they never went back. So he was very smart to the business, knew exactly what was going on all over the wrestling world, knew exactly what was going to happen, which promoter, which wrestler. He was smart. He could maneuver the winds. He kept the NWA on side until they were no longer useful to him. He was the master promoter, really, when you think about it.
Yeah, it sounds it. It's like exactly what you'd want in a promoter. And I guess you were talking about in the New Japan one about Inoki being the master sort of politician. And in a way, I guess Baba was sort of similar.
Yeah.
Maybe in a nicer way, but very much in the way of knowing how to get people on his side and keep them on his side as long as he needed them.
Yeah, I think that's the interesting thing. You know, he had close relationships with Texas, with the Funk Brothers. He had close relationships with the Briscoes. So that brings in Florida, and it brings in St. Louis, Missouri. You know, the big wrestling cities in North America. He was highly respected as a promoter, highly respected as a wrestler. Would go to the NWA territories as a draw, would go on tours as the NWA wanted him to. You know, we need a draw here. We haven't had you in a while. Will you come? So he always did his due diligence to the other promotions in the NWA. He was an attraction within himself. He was a good wrestler. He was a good booker. He knew his limitations, but he knew how to get the best out of everything. And I think that's the key difference between him and Inoki. Inoki was more ambitious, I think.
Mm.
And not that Baba wasn't ambitious, but he was more patient. You know, he was a guy who was willing to wait things out and see how things developed and then build his ideas on what he already had. And I think that's the difference between that evolution and revolution approach. Because it's evolution, you're always building on the history you have. And because of Inoki's revolution, you're always starting from scratch nearly every time.
Yeah, and it's in terms of being a good promoter, I guess. I mean, really, both ways worked out, because look at going forward into the 80s and 90s, both companies were huge. But when you look at sort of what you'd want as, I guess, a boss, the evolutionary sort of be patient, respect the history and build upon it and be sort of take things slow and be smart about things is sort of what you'd think would work better.
Yeah, I mean, there were some definite dips. There was a period in the 1980s, in the late 1970s and early 1980s, when things weren't going so well for All Japan Pro Wrestling. You know, Dynamite again said in his book, when I started with New Japan, we used to watch All Japan as a comedy half hour. And then after about a year, we discovered they'd actually really surpassed us in ring quality, and we were going OEC. So we were having to try and catch up with them. So, you know, there was a period in that late 70s, early 80s, when they're perhaps relying a little too much on nostalgia and not trying to push things forward. There was some interesting points. We was going to talk about the International Wrestling Enterprises and their cost promotion with All Japan Pro Wrestling and with New Japan Pro Wrestling, weren't we? A little bit as well. Should we explain that first? Should we explain the company first?
Yeah, let's do it.
One of our fans, Joe, who posts a lot on the YouTube channel, he asked us to do a little bit on International Wrestling Enterprise, which was a company that was founded, again, out of the ashes of the JWA, and his biggest star was Rusev Kimura, which was founded in 1966 and lasted until 1981, and did some interesting things that were pioneering in pro wrestling, certainly in Japan. They were the first company in Japan to book Andre the Giant, which is obviously a big deal. Mm-hmm. They were the first Japanese country to run a steel cage match. And they were also one of the first companies to do real interpromotional work. And they were associated with the American Wrestling Association out of Minnesota. So they had a very different style, which much more North American-based even than All Japan. Having watched the matches this week, they had a hell of a Lester Gaijin. There was more Gaijin talent wrestled for them than there was actual homegrown talent. Ryuma Go was one of the homegrown talents. Masa Saito, who's well known to as Mr. Saito in North American fans. Hiro Matsuda, a big trainer that came out of Florida who trained Hulk Hogan and, of course, Lex Luger. And then you look at the list of Gaijin. They had Billy Robinson too. He was one of their first stars. Vern Gagne. They had Luthez, Carl Gotch, Danny Hodge, Don Leo Jonathan, Bill Miller, Dick the Bruiser, Magdog Vachon, Nick Bockwinkel, basically all the AWA guys of the 1970s and 1960s. So they had a hell of a roster available to them. And they also had some favors pulled in as well from places like Stampede. Dynamite Kid wrestled for them. So did Davey Boy Smith and the Junkyard Dog, or Big Daddy Ritter, as he was known back then. And Dave Schultz, who's also another Stampede guy. And Jake Roberts, I believe, whose first Japanese tour was with International. So they were kind of a little bit of a blood and guts promotion, a bit more traditional, kind of Memphis-style wrestling. What do you think, Alex? You've seen some of this stuff, haven't you?
Yeah, so from what I was reading, they were seen as sort of the more, I guess, deathmatchy sort of style compared to the old school traditional JWA, and that's how they sort of separated themselves, which, yeah, when you see that they're the first company that put on a steel cage match and sort of trying to move the style forwards a bit, which we saw going forward more in the future of Japanese wrestling, you do get like FMW and these big, like Big Japan now, and these sort of deathmatch companies, which I guess you can trace them back to IWE. So yeah, it was an interesting sort of look at a different style of Japanese wrestling that you didn't really see from JWA. And wasn't it that when All Japan was first founded, there was sort of a group of wrestlers that left IWE and they formed quite a bit of the roster for All Japan?
Yeah, there was a lot of crossover going on. You know, IWE started in 1966, so it had 5 or 6 years jump on All Japan Pro Wrestling. However, they didn't have the TV coverage that All Japan would have because they took over the Nippon TV slot. So they were taking over network television, and IWE didn't have network TV, or not a deeper penetration as network TV that JWA had. So that, you know, to survive without that extra level as a major organization, and you had Tokyo Pro as well, it was an interesting time for Japanese wrestling, as you know, the power vacuum that came along with no Riki Dozan and who was going to fill that power vacuum kind of leveled things out. And again, yeah, you're right, it's style. This is much more Gaijin heavy kind of style company, much more deathmatch style. I mean, you look at some of the Gaijins they've got, like Gypsy Joe, for instance, who couldn't have a match without bleeding on somebody. Killer Karl Krupp is another one. You know, it's like, if you've ever seen Slapshot, the end of Slapshot, where the away team, like, there's a list of all these horrible, vile players from the histories of ice hockey come out. It's a bit like that, you know, it's just like the worst possible wrestler, not so the worst possible, the bloodiest and most violent wrestlers of all time, just on this roster list. Yeah. So yeah, it was interesting, but what did happen in the late 1970s was an invasion angle of All Japan Pro Wrestling when the company closed. Now, before that, there was a cross promotion. The IWE cross promoted with All Japan and New Japan at Budokan Hall Show in 1979 for Tokyo Sports, one of the big daily newspapers in Japan that does lots of sports coverage and lots of wrestling coverage. And also, when the company folded in 1981, the some of the big stars, Inoue, Hara, Tsurima, and Fuyuka, joined All Japan, while Kimura, Hamaguchi, and Taranashi joined New Japan. And they both created stables, had an invasion angle in Japanese wrestling, which was the first time that happened.
And that's way ahead of its time, because you think, when you think of sort of American wrestling, you don't really see that sort of thing until the NWO in the late 90s, and this was like 20 years before that.
Yeah, this was the first time it had been done. It had been done in two companies at the same time. It comes back. It's a standard kind of storytelling device in Japanese wrestling. This was the first time it happened in 1981, but you're right, it's so ahead of its time. You know, each time I think about this angle, because when me and Ben talked about New Japan and the arena filling time a couple of years ago, it was on the Troopini show, and the arena filling times of the 1990s, the biggest feud of that period was the ailing UWFI versus New Japan Pro Wrestling, which was another invasion angle, which was the actual basis for the NWO. But that was based on another invasion in All Japan Pro Wrestling from Riki Chosu's group who'd left New Japan, which was based upon the IWE breakup and the two groups that ended up being formed in All Japan and New Japan. So this is the first time it happens, but you look at there's the All Japan fallout with Riki Chosu, that's the next one. There's the UWFI invasion, that's the next one. There's the NWO in WCW, there's the NWO in New Japan, there's the Funkin' Army in FMW, there's the IWA invasion of FMW when IWA closes down. So there's at least seven or eight examples that have happened since then.
I mean, if you look at it now, you had the Suzuki-gun invasion of Noah.
Yeah, there's another
one. And then you've also, at the moment, you've got the Noah sort of invasion of New Japan, that sort of feud with Noah and the third generation.
Yeah, so this has become, I guess it's just a motif of Japanese wrestling. You know, I think again it comes down to that collectivist culture. You know, part of, and it goes back even far as Riki Dozan with the sumo kind of style of organization of pro wrestling. You know, JWA was based upon the principle of a sumo stable. You know, you have a bunch of guys. There's a hierarchy within those bunch of guys in that dojo. That dojo trains those guys, and they go up against the other stables guys.
Mm.
And originally, JWA was like a stable dojo. And then as you develop pro wrestling, there becomes the idea of factions within the dojo. You know, these are my guys, those are his guys, which gives you factions like Bullet Club and Chaos and Les Ignorables today, but gave you the classic factions like, well, Crush Gals in All Japan Women and Burning in All Japan in the 1990s. So these factions become almost as big as the company and are centered around big stars and Tenryu Gun and those groups as well. So it's really instilled and ingrained, and because you've got two separate companies and two separate philosophies of pro wrestling, that's really interesting and how this becomes such a big storytelling device.
Yeah, and I imagine, especially with that, there must have been so much backstage politics involved there. You've got these two separate companies that are still completely separate companies working together, and there must be so much, as I said, politics there with like, we want our guy to win this match, or, you know, we're not looking strong here, we've got to do this, and it must have been a nightmare to book all that stuff.
I think one of the biggest shows ever was at the Tokyo Dome. And I think it was Tokyo Sports again. I can't remember. But they ran a 14-match card, and every office in Japan put a match to the card. It was like there was New Japan, All Japan, FMW, IWA, a couple of the comedy promotions as well. No one videotaped it, by the way.
And that's it was a full house.
It was like 64,000 to see this show that was just like, It was baseball that did it, not Tokyo Sports. I'm pretty sure it was baseball. And it was just like the magazines just decided we're going to have one big show. We're going to showcase everybody to the biggest possible audience because like, that's good for pro wrestling.
Best promotion really is.
Yeah. And that was the FMW, the IWA show where they had the IWA match with Terry Funk and Leatherface with the Headhunters versus, I know, Terry Funk and Leatherface. I can't remember. It was Terry Funk on an eight-man team and Cactus Jack on the other eight-man team, and the Headhunters were in there and Leatherface, and it was just like every character in it in IWA had a barbed wire bat board match, and it's just people flying everywhere for about 60 minutes.
That sounds ridiculous, but I really want to watch it.
Yeah, I do. And apparently nobody had a camera on it. Not one person in the entire building had a camera on it.
That seems crazy that they'd put together such a big show, pack it out, and not film it.
Yeah.
It seems insane.
I've not been able to find it. I'll have to see if I can. But yeah, it's just madness. But there you go. But yes, so yeah, we'll wrap up with some key tenets here. You know, with every style we've looked at, we've tried to give you key tenets of what's going on. So in King's Road, per se, we're looking at a lot of Asian influence. We're looking at main events that are different to New Japan because they're best of three falls. So the storytelling style is very different. It's much more traditionalist. It's much more about pro wrestling moves. And you're starting to see a move towards very stiff matches. You know, I think the Funk brothers described it. I was listening to Terry Funk the other day on the Art of Wrestling podcast, and he was saying, like, the Japanese guys took it very seriously. And we were there and we could take their jobs. So they made sure we knew that they didn't like that. You know, and we gave back as good as we got. So you're starting to see this evolution of a stiff style that is kind of like the epitome of King's Road as we move forward into the 1980s and into the 1990s. There's lots of variety going on there. It's not just about traditional wrestling characters, but there's lots of masked wrestlers, there's brawlers, there's a little bit of blood and a little bit of violence, but only when it's necessary.
In a way, it's a lot more influenced by American wrestling,
yeah,
where you've got that sort of a show that's got a little bit of something for everyone, and it's sort of an overarching sort of story-based product, rather than what you saw with New Japan going in the sort of martial arts direction.
Yeah, so it's a bit more entertainment-based, if you will. Rather than being sports based. Of the sports entertainment dichotomy, it's closer to the entertainment than it is of the sport. But we'll see in future episodes how the King's Road style developed into something certainly unique and very influential on the rest of pro wrestling.
For sure. Especially when we get to, you know, the sort of the high period in the 90s, it's a lot of that stuff is really, really, really good.
We can probably spend about three episodes on Misawa versus Kawada, really, then, and just watch them. And then in June of that year, they wrestled each other again.
And let's have an hour just breaking down this one match.
Right then. Thank you very much for listening today. I'd like to thank Alex Edwards. That's Alex_Edwards_ on Twitter if you would like to talk to him. Thank you very much, sir, for your time.
And thank you for having me.
And we appreciate you listening to. Thank you very much to listening to the Wrestle Talk Podcast Network, where you can also find The Squash with Gavin Duenas and Paul Taylor, and me. Last week it was me, this week it'll be Paul Taylor, and they'll be talking about wrestling. You can also find us on WrestlePlus for $4.99 a month for a wonderful wrestling service that gives you all of the NJW stuff that has been broadcast in the UK and on the Fight Network around the world, and also all of the podcasts, bespoke content for WrestlePlus. We've got cool videos, we've got shoot interviews, it's awesome for $4.99 a month. Thank you very much for commenting on our iTunes and on our SoundCloud, on our YouTube videos. We really do appreciate that. We will get some read out. If you give us some more comments, that'd be really, really cool. We could read some of those out, because we do like hearing what you think of the show, and we genuinely appreciate you listening, and we genuinely appreciate the time you put into listening to us. So thank you very much. That's been the Troopany Show. We'll see you next week. Take care. Bye. We'll be right back.